城市匆忙，我总迷失方向，路上行人神色慌张，我内心冰凉。
Today's guest is Professor Thomas Hertog. He's head of theoretical physics at KU Leuven in Belgium. He's also a student and longtime collaborator of Stephen Hawking. Today we'll talk about Professor Hertog's research and his recent book on the origin of time.Stephen Hawking's Final Theory. This book is available in Chinese with the title 时间起源. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Your book grew out of the research you did with Stephen Hawking, and it's a very ambitious book, with a very ambitious title. So what's the motivation behind the book? How did you come to write this book?
Oh, that's a long story already. Well, Stephen asked me to write it shortly before he died. He told me that it was time for a new book. At that point, Stephen himself could hardly type a sentence, so he clearly couldn't write it himself. Why did Hawking say it was time for a new book? It's because he changed his mind on some of the fundamentals of our universe, of the Big Bang, of the origin, of our origins, ultimately. So you know that Stephen wrote a famous book in English. It's A Brief History of Time in the 1980s, right?
So when he was talking about a new book, he's referring to there was a book that he wrote before, which is a famous book.
Exactly. So that was, his call to fame. In A Brief History of Time, Hawking put forward, a theory of the Big Bang. But later it became clear that his theory of the Big Bang didn't quite work. It sort of produced an empty universe out of the Big Bang. So nothing like stars and galaxies and planets and life. So there was a huge problem with his theory of the Big Bang. And slowly we began to develop a whole new paradigm, a whole new way of thinking about the Big Bang, which towards the end of his life, we were putting together. And Stephen really realized that this was quite a change from A Brief History of Time. And that's why he asked me to write this book. So the book is really the result. The book is really about how Stephen Hawking, in the second part of his life, in the second part of his career, came to change his mind about the origin of the universe and what it means, what it means for our conception of physics, our conception of cosmology, or I would say our place in the universe. So it's a pretty cool story. And I've tried to tell the story, not in a dry scientific way, but in a way that the reader is invited into the office with Stephen and me.
So the reader would be like a fly on the wall watching you and Hawking working together.
Exactly. That's the spirit of the book, right? With all the confusion that comes with it.
You worked with Hawking for 20 years during the last part of his life. How did you come to work with Hawking? That was right after graduate school for you. Is that right?
Graduate school, at least in the US, it's when you do a PhD, when you do a doctorate, right? So I did my PhD with Hawking, and then we continued for many years after to work together. So the question, your question really is, how did I get to do my PhD with Hawking?
Exactly.
So how do young students, 20, 22, how do they find a PhD supervisor? It's a pretty random process, right? This was the late 90s, the mid 90s, really. So this was just before serious internet, this was a different world. I studied physics in Belgium, and I was interested in physics because on the one hand I was good in mathematics, and on the other hand because I had a keen interest in the big philosophical questions. And when I studied physics in Belgium, I didn't find much cosmology or these deep fundamental physics. And so I decided maybe I should go elsewhere. And then in the 90s, Cambridge, where Hawking worked, was the mecca for cosmology. It was the center, very, very famous center for cosmological research.
As an undergrad, did you already know you want to be a cosmologist?
This was my point. I didn't really know. No, I didn't know there existed a field of research in physics which draws his inspiration from, these mostly fundamental human cosmic questions. It's only when I met Hawking that I realized, whoa, here is a scientist, here is a researcher who really almost radiates this sort of cosmic humanism. Stephen had some sort of direct link almost between big questions and theoretical mathematical research. And of course, I immediately knew when I met him in Cambridge, this is what I was looking for. So I think now students are much more aware of what's out there and the different fields and this and that. But still, there was a bit of an advantage in the way that I got to know Hawking, because it was very much an intuitive search on my part, like, hey, what do I really want to do? And so the search was, first I talked to colleagues of Hawking, and eventually it was a colleague of Hawking who told me, look, Thomas, I think you should talk to Stephen. So you see, it happened in a very personal way, not through email or applications or whatever. It happened. And so I think Stephen too fairly quickly noticed there was a real match in terms of interests, in terms of scientific wavelength, in terms of sort of the deeper questions that drove us. Very nice.
When you say you met Hawking, and what was the meeting like?
Right. You could not just walk into his office. Well, you could, but it would have been a little awkward. Stephen had a very simple system to invite potential graduate students. They had a master degree, and whoever came top of the class would be invited for an interview with Hawking. And so that's what happened to me. My first meeting was some sort of job interview for a PhD, in which Stephen directly jumped into all sorts of paradoxes associated with what at that time were theories of the multiverse, the idea there are many universes and you get lost, right? Because the theory doesn't tell you in which universe we should be, and therefore it doesn't tell you what we should be observing. And so Stephen was really involved in big, big fights and discussions with fellow cosmologists on the question whether the multiverse makes any sense as a scientific theory. And so he was fulminating during my job interview against his cosmology colleagues about these crazy multiverse theories. And already then he was saying there should be a better way, there should be a different way, we're missing something. What are we missing? And this was the beginning of these 20 years of collaboration. I realized this is what I wanted to do. This field is what I was looking for all the time. And he realized, I think, that he had a capable student who was interested and willing and capable in following him to the deepest roots of cosmology. You see, the problem that we were trying to address, and that my book is about, is really about not just the details of one theory of another of the universe, but about the fundamentals of physics itself. What is physics? What are the laws of nature? What is the origin of the laws of nature? Why are these laws strangely biophilic? Why is this universe fit for life at the level of the properties of the laws of physics? It was a philosophical question before.
By philosophical, you mean it's outside of the realm of science. It's not a question that science tries to answer.
Exactly. In our traditional conception of physics, the laws are a given. They're eternal, fixed truths. You do not ask what is the origin of the laws of physics. You try to figure out what they are. And so, confronted with the strangely biophilic properties of the laws, with the idea that there's something special about the laws of physics, and that this has to be special in order for the universe to be full of life, in order for us to exist, this was an observation that had to mean something. There must be some sort of link, some sort of unity behind, on the one hand, our existence, and on the other hand, these very special laws of physics coming out of the Big Bang. And so Stephen wasn't ready to leave this just as a philosophical question. He thought, no, this is telling us something about physics, about the deepest roots of physics. I was completely thrilled by meeting a person who was a physicist, who was willing to question physics itself, to reinvent physics itself, to change, to question our notion, our conception of, hey, where do these laws of physics come from, really? That was the beginning of our collaboration.
It's such an important point. I just want to repeat it for our listeners. So upon my reading of the book, the central motivation of the book and of much of the research that you and Stephen Hawking collaborated on is trying to answer the question, why is this universe that we live in, we find ourselves in, so fine-tuned for life? There are so many constants, physical constants in this universe. If they're just off by just a little bit, then life wouldn't exist. And Stephen Hawking wants to answer it from a science, from a physics perspective. The traditional answer to this, why the universe is so fine-tuned for life, is the multiverse explanation. So what is the multiverse explanation, and why did Hawking and I assume you find it as satisfying?
I would say that before we come to the multiverse, the really traditional explanation, before the multiverse became popular in the 80s and certainly in the 90s, but the explanation that Isaac Newton or Albert Einstein or those people, or even Steven Weinberg, the explanation that those people would have advanced is the fine-tuning, the strange biophilic properties of the universe are a mathematical necessity. You see, the laws of physics, mathematically, they have to click together a little bit like one of these puzzles, right? Everything has to sort of fit together. And so the dream of Einstein was the mathematics is going to guide us to a theory of everything, which is going to tell us how the universe should be. In other words, the explanation for the fine-tuning would be some sort of deeper mathematical truth. And of course, that led nowhere. No one ever found a kind of uniqueness of our universe encoded in purely in mathematics. And then, as you say, through studies, I would say, of quantum effects in cosmology, the idea became popular. But wait a minute, maybe the Big Bang isn't the beginning. Maybe the Big Bang isn't unique. Maybe there are many Big Bangs. And maybe we live in a gigantic expanding space full of little universes, full of expanding universes like bubbles. And each of these universes would be sort of a local Big Bang. And maybe these universes could have different local laws of physics, different kinds of particles, different kinds of forces. And maybe most of them would be lifeless, but once in a while, you're going to find a good one. So this became very popular because it was such a different explanation. From mathematical uniqueness, you go to everything is possible. So it was a huge shift. And the reason Hawking in the late 90s, and I think he must have been one of the first ones to realize that this multiverse didn't quite work. And it had to do not with the simple fact that, of course, we can't go to another universe and check it out. We're stuck here. This was not the real reason. The real reason was that a multiverse theory does not make unambiguous predictions for what we in this universe should be observing. It means that it is not even testable in principle from within this universe. Because if you want to test a physical theory, the very first thing you need, the minimal thing you need, is that the theory makes clean predictions. Now you're going to ask, but why does the multiverse theory not make clean predictions? The reason is that the theory does not tell us in which universe we are, in which universe we should be. So if you have different universes with different kinds of Higgs particles or different kinds of dark energy, and the theory doesn't tell us in which one we should be, and if some of these universes can be are habitable, yeah, then we cannot really test the theory. So there was a kind of falsification, lack of falsifiability, lack of testability, which made Stephen think that there is something profoundly wrong with this kind of multiverse thinking. If you wish, in biology, suppose Darwin had taken the same kind of line and he would have said, aha, I am going to study biology by looking at all possible planets. And I'm going to look at the tree of life on all possible planets. And then I'm going to predict, I'm going to tell you what is the most probable tree of life. And that's going to be ours. Darwin didn't do that. Darwin didn't do that at all. It's possible there is life on other planets, but life on other planets doesn't affect, doesn't enter in the scientific understanding of how the tree of life on this planet evolved. And so it's the same with the multiverse theory. Why should all these other universes be important to understand the evolution of this one? But in order to do that Darwinian step, it took us 20 years. The title of my book, On the Origin of Time, is of course a variation of Darwin's title, On the Origin of Species. It amounts to some sort of Darwinian revolution in cosmology. The idea that in the earliest stages of the universe, also the laws of physics co-evolved with the universe. So the laws of physics we have today in our hypothesis are themselves the result of an early evolution. So in a sense, we turned cosmology inside out. We changed the paradigm.
I think a lot of people would agree, I would agree that the multiverse explanation and the Anthropic principle, which is related to the multiverse explanation, are somewhat unsatisfying because, as you said, it's unfalsifiable. But what gives Hawking the conviction that the explanation lies within physics, that physics is able to give it an answer to it? Because I think some people would just be, okay, you know, it's by definition outside the realm of science. Some people would live happily with that.
Right, but not Hawking.
It almost seems that Hawking's conviction grows out of aesthetic. Maybe there's no strong logical reason why it shouldn't be that way or should be that way. But him as a physicist, as a mathematician, it's distasteful to him.
Okay, so that's a very good question. So as you say, the Anthropic principle was essentially an attempt to rescue the multiverse theory by augmenting it with a non-scientific principle that would select a habitable universe. But the minute you have two or three or four different habitable universes, the Anthropic principle once again doesn't tell you which one it should be, and you're back to square one. But then to your question, I think there are two parts to the answer. One is connected to what you say. It is indeed, if you put it bluntly, it was Hawking's working hypothesis that there should be a science explanation. He was an epistemic optimist. The drive in his life was to understand this business around us. And this came from so deep with him. This was such a passionate drive, because I think he thought that if we're going to understand these deepest questions about how the universe works, we're also going to understand something about ourselves, about our place in the universe, about we're going to find the seeds of some sort of worldview in which humanity, in which, in a sense, I would say we almost find a home within the universe. You see, the result of the scientific revolution and this idea of physics and these objective laws is in many ways some sort of separation between our existence on the one hand and physics, the laws of physics on the other hand. I think deep down, Stephen felt this is not correct. There must be some sort of deeper connection. In order to find this connection, you have, and that was the genius, you must generalize your idea of physics. You must go beyond the current framework of physics. So Hawking was one of these people that, one of these great scientists like Newton and Einstein, who weren't happy or were conscious that the way we understand physics and science now is not the end point. We can crack it open. We can go further. And then, of course, this question about the biophilic universe is an X and the paradoxes. So it's always with paradoxes, right? Paradoxes associated with the multiverse were very important because they guided us. They showed us how to crack open physics. So that's one part. It's indeed this sort of conviction, intuition. But it's not just a conviction in I think, the way you meant it. It's a conviction rooted in the crisis. Rooted in the crisis of the multiverse. That's why I think important. The second point goes back to his Brief History of Time, to his book. There, as I mentioned, he put forward a theory of the Big Bang that didn't work. But there was one thing about his theory which was pure genius and which turned out to be important. In A Brief History of Time, Stephen put forward a new kind of physical law, a law that describes a genuine origin, an initial condition, and not just a law like any other law we know, which are laws of evolution. The laws of Einstein or the laws of Schrödinger or the laws of Newton, all physical laws we know are laws of evolution. You specify a system and then the law will tell you how it evolves. But we never had a law of physics that describes the initial state. There was always something exterior to the laws. And of course, this was a paradox when it comes to the Big Bang, because who is specifying the state, the initial state at the Big Bang? So Hawking came up with a different kind of law, a law which is a law of evolution that morphs into an initial condition. And I think that kind of insight, which goes back to the 80s, made Hawking convinced that it should be possible to include the actual origin in science and not leave it outside science. And in other words, to include also, to try also in the 90s then, to include this mystery of why the universe is biophilic in physics and not outside physics. So it's, I think, this combination, but it's a very interesting question.
If I can paraphrase that, Hawking wanted or believed that physics can go a lot further than what most other people think physics can do.
That is correct. That is correct. And so in a way, the crux of our... It's his second part of his career. What my book is about is really an attempt to, as I mentioned, to crack open physics, to go further and to not accept the laws of physics as a given, as a prior truth, but to delve into their origin. And so we find that this origin of the laws of physics as we know them today, that these laws of physics are themselves the result of an evolution. So there's a sort of a tree of laws that develops in the earliest stages of the universe, but when the universe expands and cools, these laws crystallize, they're fixed. They're like the crystal structure of ice or so. They're fixed and they provided then a foundation for all higher levels of evolution, the chemical evolution, the astrophysical evolution, the biological evolution. It builds on these laws of physics. And because the laws of physics are the bottom level, we think of these laws as fixed things. It's because their evolutionary nature only reveals itself in the earliest stages of the universe. That's why that level of evolution has so far remained obscure. We lack fossils, in a way, of this deepest layer of evolution. So it's a beautiful story, I think, which resolves these paradoxes with the multiverse. And at the same time, I view this theory as a sort of a beacon of where, because our theory isn't finished and we still have to test it and this and that. So it's a beacon of where physics can reach in the 21st century.
So let me repeat that point and follow up with some questions. So although we experience physical laws as fixed, at the very beginning of the universe, physical laws were fluctuating. Other constants perhaps were changing and the laws were changing. And somehow they settled down into a state or into a configuration that's turned out to be very well suited for life. And this is the alternative explanation to the multiverse explanation. And in the book, you made this extraordinary statement that the history of the evolution of physical laws is precisely because we here now are observing the universe. To quote you, we are participants in the universe. And by our very own act of observing, we went back to the very beginning of the history of the universe and shaped the physical laws to make it such that it's suited for life. Is that a correct characterization of your statement?
Yes and no. There are various levels at which we can discuss this most subtle point. So at a general level, just like Darwinian evolution doesn't give a prior explanation for how the tree of life should develop, the hypothesis that Hawking and I developed of the earliest stages of the universe doesn't give a prior explanation of how the tree of physical laws should develop. No, it gives a retrospective explanation. Darwin starts from the fossils and the species that he observes, and he reconstructs the tree of life, assuming a single origin. Same with Hawking and me. We start from the physical laws we have today, and we reconstruct the tree of laws, assuming a common origin. So that's one level. The explanation we provide is not a prior explanation. As you say, it could have turned out differently. The tree of life, the tree of laws could have turned out differently. In the space of possibilities, all these tree of lives and all these tree of laws are out there, but they don't directly interfere with the scientific process of reconstructing the tree of life or the tree of laws in this universe. Then the next level, I think what you were aiming at is about how does this tree of law, how does this work? How does this selection process, what is the analog of natural selection in physics? And then indeed we come to this strange property of quantum theory, the fact that the act of observation, measuring things, is what sort of crystallizes one branch of reality, one set of physical laws over the other. Like Schrödinger's cat or like an electron, take an electron. An electron in quantum theory doesn't have a position until you measure its position. So until you interact with the particle, until you establish a correlation with the electron and so forth. Oh, before that, it has just possible positions. It's a realm of what's possible. Well, it sort of describes, it's almost reality at some sort of pre-existential level. And so what Hawking and I have done is to take that quantum thinking, which was developed in the context of particles and atoms, and we've applied this to the evolution of the early universe. Now you might think, well, wait a minute. We're not observing in the early, we're not there in the earliest.
But we were now around.
Exactly. We were not around. So who was observing? And the clue, of course, is that it doesn't need to be a human observer in quantum theory. Anything can act as an observer. Even a single photon can perform an observation by interacting with a particle. And so this primitive environment, this very, very primitive environment in the early universe, in which even the different forces of nature and the different particles hadn't been crystallized, that primitive environment was observing itself through the interactions that were taking place. And in doing so, crystallizing one outcome of the Big Bang over another. So there's a subtle retroactive element in quantum theory, in which you should think of as an ocean of uncertainty, gradually observations sort of select a tangible, concrete reality. And if you, that's this participatory element of quantum theory, apply to the early universe, it has the shocking consequence that these laws of physics are the result of an evolution.
So one question I have upon reading sort of the analogy between the evolution of physical laws to the to biological evolution, Darwinian evolution, where Darwinian evolution is still happening now. But with physical laws, that seemed to be only happening at the very beginning of the universe. So why did it stop? Why did the physical law evolution stop?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. The short answer is that to trigger this evolutionary character, you need extremely, extremely high temperatures, extreme, extreme conditions. What happened in the earliest stages of the universe is when it cooled down, is a number of transitions. Much like when water cools and becomes ice, you form more structures. Through these transitions in the earliest universe, yeah, you form more forces, more particles, more diversification. It is not that the evolution or that a change in the laws of physics, it's not excluded today. It's not 100% excluded, but it's extremely, extremely unlikely. You could ask a different question, related, I think. So what about the far, far future? Are the laws of physics going to be eternal now? The answer is no. If they're fundamentally evolutionary, then at some point, yeah, eternity is very long, right? At some point, some sort of change will happen. And so the result is of this thinking, of this evolutionary thinking, is that reality, space, time, the universe, it doesn't extend infinitely. No, we are living in a universe, in a tangible, concrete reality of matter and space and time. But that reality is there's a finitude, there's a finiteness to it. It is not correct to extrapolate to the infinite future, to the infinite past. It's as if we live in, and that's the key point. Stephen and I have tried to understand the universe from within, from an observer's viewpoint, by using quantum theory to let ourselves be part of this universe, instead of like someone like Newton or Einstein or the earlier Hawking in A Brief History of Time, who were trying to understand the cosmos as if they're outside from a sort of godlike viewpoint. And then you are quickly let into this multiverse theories ultimately, right? What is the multiverse theory? It's an attempt to understand the universe and all universes as if you're outside, hovering above it. Hawking left this completely behind towards the end of his life.
And in contrast to the God's eye view, Hawking came up with the worm's eye view.
Right, yeah. So he had to find another name, right? But indeed, that's typically Hawking, right? We were trying to, just like Darwin, right? A Homo sapiens in the tree of life is a branch of this tree of life. And in the same way, we are trying to put this perspective, this obvious fact that we are within the universe, we were trying to get us into the equations. And of course, we needed a new name for that. I'm not sure the name is very good, but the name at least makes the point.
The book has some very interesting analogies that really help you, help the reader understand the science, to make the science accessible. One great analogy, of course, is in the title of the book, to compare the evolution of physics to biological evolution. Another one would be when we just said about the God's eye view versus the worm's eye view. So you came up with this idea of a top-down cosmology as an alternative to the multiverse explanation.
Yeah.
And then towards the end of the book, you made the extraordinary statement that we're living in a hologram. Please explain that, and how does it tie up with everything we've said before about the universe being fine-tuned and top-down cosmology?
Okay. You're asking difficult questions.
Well, the reason I'm asking, because I could follow along fairly well until that chapter. Then out of nowhere, we live in the hologram.
Well, yeah, some people detest that last chapter, and some people love it. So
I'm curious.
I can't help it. Right. let me try to sketch the answer in general terms first for non-physicists. So Hawking and I had this intuition that we should, in a sense, in order to understand why the universe is fit for life, that we should not try to look at the universe or try to conceive the universe from a godlike perspective, but more from a worm's eye perspective, from the perspective of an observer, of an entity within the universe. And this intuition got us reasonably far, but at the end of the day, this an intuitive picture in theoretical physics has to be grounded in equations, because it's the mathematical equations, the formula, that ultimately are enable you to make actual predictions and to test your hypothesis. And so, as I mentioned, traditional physics was not ready for this intuition. It was based on this absolute notion of laws, fixed laws, and all sorts of things, until we bumped into this giant new idea of holography. So holography is a discovery, not in cosmology, but in string theory, so in a very mathematical realm of theoretical physics, aimed at getting Einstein's theory of gravity and space and time to work together with quantum theory, the theory of particles and atoms. In that context, in the search for a theory that makes these two work together, theoretical physicists in the early part of this century stumbled upon this strange idea of holography, of the idea that our universe is kind of, that the world is kind of a hologram. So let me first explain a little bit what this is about, and then I will answer your question why this matters for the Big Bang. So think of a black hole. A black hole is a collapsed star. It's a region in space. Inside a black hole, Einstein's theory breaks down. There's a singularity, time ends. But going back many, many years, Hawking and others discovered that all there is to know about a black hole, about the inside of a black hole, is probably encoded, contained. The information is probably coded on the surface of the black hole, what is called the horizon of a black hole. And so this is very, very strange, because you can then imagine, if all there is to know about the black hole, if all that information is somehow encoded on the surface, perhaps in some sense, the black hole does not have an inside. Perhaps there is no inside, or perhaps it's just a possible perspective to say there is an inside. But maybe there's a different way of thinking about a black hole, a holographic way, in which I envision a physical theory entirely located on the surface of a black hole. That would be a quantum theory grounded in the qubits, in the information located on the surface. And so that's where the idea of holography was born. The idea of holography states that gravity, space, and time have holographic properties. One of the dimensions, one of the familiar dimensions of the world around us, the three space dimensions and the time dimensions, one of these dimensions is not quite real. It's a holographic projection. Just like in a normal hologram, you have the third space dimension popping out. In a black hole, the inside dimension is popping out of the information located on the surface. So this was very strange. And for many, many years, theoretical physicists didn't quite know what to make of this. Until in the early stages of the 21st century, it became clear that these holographic properties of gravity and space and time are much more general, not just for black holes. Many other systems have these as well. And so it became a crucial question. Hey, what about this universe? The universe as a whole is one of the dimensions, not quite real. Well, so that we Stephen and I started to study this, and we discovered that the time dimension, the evolution in time, the expansion of the universe, that the time evolution is really the holographic projection. And of course, in retrospect, it's all clear. The time dimension was the problem from the start with the Big Bang. The Big Bang is the origin of time. You're not going to understand truly the origin of time if you do not develop a new kind of physics in which time is not a priori, but in which time is an emergent holographic popping out dimension, because that's only the system in which you can then understand the limitations of your time. And so, to make a long story short, this whole Darwinian intuition we had is almost automatic once you start to think about the earliest stages of the universe in a holographic way. It's grounded in our observational perspective within the origin of time becomes the limit where also physics disappears, and so forth. So that was that's really when Stephen, when it all clicked and when Stephen said, okay, this is on the right track, it's time for a new book. And so you're stuck with that last chapter.
I don't pretend that I understood everything in that chapter, but I have to say, to single out the time dimension as an emergent property, in other words, time is not real, to me it's very satisfying, because of all the dimensions that we're familiar with, time is always the odd one out.
That's right. That's right. Time has always been the problem in many ways in physics.
It breaks a lot of symmetry. It can only go one way.
That's right. That's right. So this is, of course, very, very fascinating at a more general level. As you just say, time has always been the problem in physics. And maybe we are now seeing the tip of the iceberg of a new kind of physics, in which we, in a way, finally get rid of time as one of the sort of fundamental prior assumptions. It's very fascinating. Yeah, but we haven't seen the end of it.
My question is then, I'm not even sure how to phrase it. If we are living in a hologram, what does it make of us? Like, what are we doing? What are we doing here, having this conversation with time passing very uniformly by? If it's not real, what does it even mean?
Okay, so this is of course, I don't quite know, but I can speculate. The holographic nature of the universe, the hologram, reveals itself clearly, and this is very interesting, in those regions of the universe where the normal thinking, the normal perception of reality, like the one we have now, is under pressure, is no longer valid. In black holes, the normal notion of time, inside black holes, time comes to an end. And then there is this holographic property of the surface of a black hole that sort of comes to the forefront. Same in the Big Bang. The Big Bang is the origin of time. The holographic nature, the fact that time does not continue to flow, all of a sudden becomes very important. But in the normal day-to-day life, like now, the holographic nature of the universe is hidden. It is much more easier to just think in terms of space and time. But okay, you can ask the question purely theoretically. I can still look at my hologram. What are these holograms? These holograms of a black hole or of the universe as a whole, they're extremely complicated quantum systems. They're highly, highly entangled. They're in a sense, they're a little bit like the kind of quantum systems that engineers are trying to build quantum computers. So the idea, but this is very general, and we do not understand this in detail, but the grand idea behind this is that we are beginning to think about the universe as a whole as some sort of quantum computer, in which the entanglement, in which the interactions, those are, generate a notion of time rather than having this built in a priori. So it's a strange idea. It almost suggests some sort of worldview in which there is a sort of a quantum code behind the whole thing operating. This is really, really speculative, but it sort of points to an interesting thing, I think. It points to a merger of, once again, gravity and cosmology. So somehow this is what's happening in the research today. there are a lot of ideas of quantum information getting integrated and absorbed and developed in the context of the science of the universe, of cosmology. Where this will lead us, I don't know. And so the last chapter of my book is an exposition of where this might lead us, but many research is required to put this on firmer footing, and that's what we are doing now.
What experiments or observations, if done, would further give supporting evidence to your theories or would actually falsify it? And are we doing any of these experiments now?
So at the time of his death, Stephen was working on a scientific paper in which he was zooming in on gravitational waves as a way of testing our hypothesis. And gravitational waves are ripples. They're not like light waves, but they're a sort of radiation associated with the fabric of space itself. When space expands, it sort of vibrates. When the universe expands, it creates its own ripples. And this very first phase of the universe goes together with such ripples of space, which are gravitational waves. I think this is probably the way to test our hypothesis. You see, with light waves, we can look back in time. Right? We can look billions of years back in time, but we can't look back all the way to the Big Bang. The earliest stages of the universe are opaque. They're in the mist. They're inaccessible. But the gravitational waves that are generated in these earliest stages, they travel freely. They don't care about this fireball at the beginning. And so I guess gravitational waves are the fossils that we're interested in. The way this tree of physical laws emerged is probably encoded in the bursts of gravitational waves that are associated with all these transitions in the early universe. So, but gravitational waves are very, very hard to measure. People have measured a few of gravitational waves from black holes, but we have not seen gravitational waves from these earliest stages of the universe. So I think that's sort of the hope that we can piece together, that we can glimpse this deeper layer of evolution that we hypothesize by studying the universe, not with light, but with gravitational waves. That's, I guess, the challenge for the 21st century.
And are there actually people, physicists out there trying to measure gravitational waves?
Yeah. What is happening now is that people have detected a few gravitational waves from black holes. But a whole new set of big observatories up in space and also here on Earth are being developed, which will be operational in 10 years or so, which are going to unlock the entire universe and measure all these gravitational waves. And so I guess that will be the time to test this hypothesis.
So in 10 years, we'll revisit this podcast and maybe do a follow-up then.
That's a deal, yeah. In the end, I think I try to write it as a detective story because that's how it felt. That's what it was. It was a search with lots of confusion and the occasional insight. And the fly on the wall effect, the fact that I invite a reader in the office with Hawking gives, I think, a bit of a detective element to it, which I hope is fun.
And I think you did just that. A fascinating book to read.
Thank you.
Today's guest is Professor Thomas Hertog, longtime collaborator of Stephen Hawking and author of the book On the Origin of Time. It's a mind-boggling book with some very counterintuitive ideas. For our listeners, I hope this interview has made these ideas more accessible. Thomas, congratulations on having written an extraordinary book, and thank you for coming to the show.
Thank you so much. That was fun.
Yeah, it's really been fun. And
我的脚已不再重要，说一声你好，紧张不得了，你的脸上写满。